This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, good evening. I think we're going to get started. Welcome to The Multidimensional Mind, Week 2. My name is Gil Rabinovich. I'm an assistant professor and neurologist at the UCSF Memory and Aging Center. And today we're going to talk about how brain circuits break down in diseases that cause dementia, and then how we can think about fixing them. And I'll kick us off by starting a discussion on Alzheimer's disease. Then my colleague, Dr. Bill Seeley, will talk about a disease called frontotemporal dementia that really affects a very distinct group of brain circuits. And both Bill and I, as we go, will introduce some imaging techniques that we have to assess the integrity of these circuits, both in health and disease. And then after Bill and I are finished breaking the brain, our colleague Dr. Adam Boxer, who directs our clinical trials program, will tell us how we can put the brain back together, tell us about some very exciting new ideas about therapy for these really devastating diseases. So, as a neurologist, I learn about diseases by seeing patients. And so I thought I'd begin with a case presentation. This is a patient that I cared for. We'll call him Sergeant M. He's a 70-year-old man. He has diabetes, high cholesterol. And the first time I met him, he just sat in my office and said, "My memory's terrible, doc." His wife reported that over the past 3 to 4 years, he's become more forgetful. And it's really for sort of trivial day-to-day things. He'll forget conversations or TV shows that they watch together. For example, that morning, he had no recollection that he had a memory clinic appointment in San Francisco, even though he and his wife had had a long conversation the night before about how they'd have to get up early to make the drive. He tended to repeat himself, tell the same stories, ask the same questions, sometimes within an hour. And his memory for remote events, major life events that happened 10, 20, 30 years ago, was actually preserved. In fact, if anything, he tended to reminisce more than ever about the good old days. Now, he's really a very outgoing, gregarious person, kind of the life of the party, but more recently, especially in large social groups, he tended to fade to the background. And the month before he saw me, he was driving to his home in Ukiah from a medical appointment in San Francisco, and this is a route that he had navigated many, many times before, but for some reason this time he got lost and couldn't figure out how to get back on track and ended up needing to stop at a gas station and call his wife to try to figure out how to get home. So when patients come to us with cognitive complaints, we try to objectively assess their cognition, and we put them through a battery of cognitive tests, and then we compare their performance, say on tests of memory, to normative values that we have adjusting for age and education. And so when we test memory, we have several different kinds of tests that we use. Here's an example of one. On this test, we have patients memorize this long list of words. And the way it works is that the tester will say the words out loud slowly, and then the patient will be asked to repeat the words. And they go through this again and again 4 times to give the patient a good chance to learn the words. And so here we are with our patient, and this is his 4th time through this list.
Peaches, lemons, cherries, belt, hat.
All right, so I'm going to reveal some tricks of the trade here, but even though there are 9 words on this list, they all fall into 1 of 3 categories. And actually, patients who can figure that out as they're hearing the list can memorize the list more efficiently than, say, if they're trying to memorize it in the order that the words are presented. Now, our patient clearly did actually figure this out and try to put the words together in categories, but even so, he could only learn after 4 trials 6 of the 9 words, which is abnormal for his age. Now, 10 minutes later, we've kept him busy with other tests, and then we ask him just to remember all the words that he can from the same list. And so pay attention here not only to the words that he remembers, but also to the errors that he makes.
A few minutes ago, I read a list of words to you several times. Tell me all the words you can remember on that list.
Rich.
All right, so a couple of points here. One is that even after just 10 minutes, he's already forgotten 4 of the 6 words that he had memorized. So he's showing rapid forgetting. Now, he's making mistakes, but the mistakes are really coming up with words that are in the same categories, even though they're not the right words. These are called related intrusions. And both of these, the rapid forgetting and the intrusions, are characteristic of the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. So on his cognitive testing, his main problem was clearly in memory. His impairment was in the moderate to severe range, but he also showed some problems with other cognitive domains that are really mediated by other brain networks, other brain regions. He had some trouble with language, naming less frequent items, some trouble judging spatial relationships or copying complicated figures, and he had a little bit of trouble with what we call executive functioning, which is thinking in an abstract way or a flexible way. So memory was worse, but there were other cognitive domains involved. Now, our first approach as clinicians is to do some basic blood tests, to look at electrolytes, to make sure the major organs are functioning, there's no hormone deficiencies, vitamin deficiencies. The brain is very sensitive to all these things, and occasionally when we do this kind of testing, we find something simple that we can treat and that will help cognition. But in this case, all the tests came out normal. And finally, we do brain imaging, and so this is an MRI of the brain, and just to orient you, this is the strip of is the gray matter where most of the brain cells are concentrated. This is the white matter of the brain, or the cables that connect the brain together, and then these fluid-filled areas are called ventricles. They're full of cerebrospinal fluid. And the most striking finding on this imaging study is look how thin the brain is here in this area. These structures are called the hippocampi. And they're incredibly important for making new memories and retrieving memories. And so hippocampal atrophy is really the signature on MRI of Alzheimer's disease. But the brain is atrophying in other regions as well. What you see here is a statistical map comparing gray matter in patients with Alzheimer's disease compared to age-matched controls. And you see that in addition to the hippocampus, the disease is really causing atrophy in large regions, especially in the back of the brain. This is the front of the brain, this is the back. So the temporal lobes, the parietal lobes, and if you think about these regions, they're very important for many of the functions that are lost early in Alzheimer's disease. So certainly memory, but also language, math, tool manipulation in the left hemisphere, navigation and spatial reasoning in the right hemisphere. There's also a little bit of tissue loss here on the outside of the frontal lobes, and these are the areas that are very important for executive functioning, again, our ability to think abstractly or flexibly. And really the regions that are spared are circuits that are in the medial parts of the frontal lobes, inside here, and as you'll hear from Dr. Seeley, these regions are incredibly important for social and emotional functioning, and really these are the things that are preserved early in Alzheimer's disease in most cases. So we've seen where the damage is. Now, what causes the damage? Well, in Alzheimer's disease, we think the bad guys are 2 classes of sticky proteins that are aggregating in the brain like toxic waste dumps and poisoning the brain cells. And what you see here is a pathology slide from a patient who died with Alzheimer's disease. And this slide really demonstrates the 2 key features of the disease at autopsy. So these structures that look a little bit like flowers, they have a dense core, and here the petals, are called amyloid plaques. They're outside the cells, and they're composed of a number of things, but mainly of a protein called amyloid beta, or A-beta. And then these flame-shaped structures are actually inside neurons or brain cells. They're called neurofibrillary tangles, and they're composed of a protein called tau. And so when the pathologist looks at the brain to make a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, they look for both the plaques and the tangles. Now, how do plaques and tangles form? Well, I'm going to get a little molecular here, but I'm going to walk you through everything. Let's start with the amyloid plaques. They begin with a protein called the amyloid precursor protein, or APP, and this is a protein that sits in the cell membrane. So here's the membrane of the cell. Now, the normal function of this protein in the brain is really not known. It seems to have something to do with fine-tuning the electrical connections between the cells, but we don't really know what the protein does. What we do know is that it can be processed in two different ways. So it can be cleaved here by a protein called alpha secretase, and that creates this waste product that the cell can actually, the brain can recycle and get rid of. This is kind of the environmentally friendly way of getting rid of APP. This is composting, if you will, over here. The brain can recycle this, get rid of it. Alternatively, APP can be cut here by a protein called beta secretase, and over here by a protein called gamma secretase. And that creates a little fragment called the A-beta fragment. And this is the sticky protein. One A-beta sticks to another, creates these aggregates that are initially in solution. These are called A-beta oligomers. And these are incredibly toxic to neurons. Eventually, the sticky oligomers make the big plaques that we can actually see under the microscope. So these are the landfills, okay? These are the things that the brain can't get rid of and that continue to poison the brain. So this is how the plaques are formed. Now, all of us are actually producing this A-beta fragment right now. In fact, the more active a neuron is, the more A-beta it produces. But fortunately, we're also clearing it, hopefully at the same rate. What happens in Alzheimer's disease is either you produce too much of this fragment or clear it too slowly, and as a result, you start to accumulate the sticky protein. Now, the neurofibrillary tangles are made of a protein called tau, and to understand what tau does, I have to tell you about microtubules. So microtubules are part of the skeleton of the cell. Here's a neuron, the cell body, the nucleus. You see it has this long process here called an axon, and here are the terminal parts of the neuron. The microtubules have a lot of functions. They stabilize the structure of the cell, but they're also the highway that allows the neuron to deliver different things, RNA, proteins, energy, nutrients, down into the terminal. So this is the highway system. And what tau does is it binds to the microtubules and stabilizes them, maintains those highways. But in Alzheimer's disease, tau disassembles from the microtubules. The microtubules become unstable, and the highways start to break down. In addition to that, tau, just like A-beta, becomes sticky. So one tau molecule sticks to another and eventually forms the tangles that we can see under the microscope. So this slide just tries to put all this together. I think Dr. Vossel showed a similar slide. Here's a neuron secreting A-beta. It's forming these sticky oligomers that are injuring this neuron here and here. The oligomers are also triggering an inflammatory response. So here's an immune cell being activated and secreting a lot of inflammatory markers that are literally stunning this neuron over here. Here's an amyloid plaque generating an inflammatory response. Here's tau sticking together and forming tangles. So there's a lot going on in the brain in Alzheimer's disease. Now, until recently, the only way that we could confirm that plaques and tangles were present was at the time of autopsy. But really, the major advance in the field in the last 15 or so years is that we now recognize that we can actually detect the plaques and tangles during life. And the first way that this was done was actually in the cerebrospinal fluid. So Americans don't like to get spinal taps, but it turns out that in Sweden, people don't mind getting spinal taps. In fact, it's part of a lot of routine medical care. And so researchers in Sweden found that amyloid plaques, when they aggregate in Alzheimer's disease, lead to a decrease in the spinal fluid levels of the A-beta fragment. Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense. If there's a lot of A-beta accumulating in the brain, why is there actually less A-beta in the spinal fluid? Well, we don't really know, but one way to think about it is imagine these plaques as sinks that are sucking all the soluble A-beta out of solution so that there's actually less soluble A-beta available in the spinal fluid if there are a lot of plaques in the brain. In addition to that, you can measure increases in tau in the spinal fluid, probably as the cells are dying with the tangles, they're releasing tau. And so if you combine these two into a ratio, you can actually very accurately discriminate patients who had Alzheimer's disease from people who are normal with very high accuracy just based on their spinal fluid profile. Now, I said Americans don't like spinal taps, but we don't mind expensive imaging tests. And so about 10 years ago, researchers at the University of Pittsburgh found a way to image amyloid plaques during life. What they did is they took a molecule that pathologists have been using to stain the brain for amyloid for many years, called thioflavin. They modified it and put on a radioisotope, carbon-11, which emits a radioactive signal. And they called their molecule Pittsburgh Compound B. This molecule is injected IV. If there are amyloid plaques present, it binds to them and sends a radioactive signal that can actually be detected with an imaging technique called a PET scan. What you see here is a PET scan of a patient with Alzheimer's disease, and all this red indicates area where the Pittsburgh compound PIB has bound and is sending off a radioactive signal. In fact, these are areas of the brain that we know have amyloid. So this kind of imaging technique, the ability to detect the plaques during life, has really revolutionized our understanding of the disease, as I'll show you in a few slides, and I think very soon will lead to major changes in how we diagnose and treat Alzheimer's. All right, so why does this happen? Why do people get Alzheimer's disease? Well, about 1% of people who have the disease have a mutation in a single gene, and if you have this mutation, you're going to get Alzheimer's disease, usually at a young age, in the 40s, sometimes even in the 30s. And all of the genes that cause familial Alzheimer's disease are genes that are involved in overproducing the A-beta fragment, either mutations in the amyloid precursor protein itself or in other proteins that cleave APP to create the bad fragment. Now, this is very uncommon. What is much more common is the apolipoprotein E4 gene. APOE4 is a gene that's present in about 20% of the population, but in about 50 to 70% of patients with Alzheimer's disease. So it's what we call a risk-modifying gene, in the sense that if you have the gene, it doesn't mean you'll get the disease, and many people get the disease without the gene, but it certainly increases the odds that you will get the Alzheimer's disease. The next risk factor for getting Alzheimer's is getting older. So the frequency of Alzheimer's is about 1% in people who are in their early 60s. And then the rule of thumb is that it roughly doubles every 5 years. And so you can imagine this exponential increase. And by the time you're getting into the late 80s, early 90s, this is incredibly common. Something like 30 to 40% of people have Alzheimer's disease. For reasons that we don't really understand, women are at higher risk than men of getting the disease, even if you adjust for the fact that women live longer than men. Head trauma, especially repetitive, high-impact head trauma, increases the risk of the disease, and of course there's a lot of interest in this now in professional sports and in the military. Anything that's bad for the heart is bad for the brain, so all these vascular risk factors, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, tobacco use, all increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease. And finally, very interestingly, our level of cognitive but also physical activity throughout our lifespan can actually modify our risk of getting Alzheimer's disease in older age. So your level of physical activity and cognitive activity in the 30s and 40s can impact the risk of developing the disease 30 or 40 years later. What decreases the risk? Education. So your mini med school tuition is very well spent here. More good news, a little alcohol is not a bad thing. So if you enjoy a little glass of red wine with dinner every now and then, that probably is actually good for brain aging. The corollary of what I said previously, so people who are more cognitively and physically active throughout the lifespan seem to be somewhat protected. And then eating healthy, a Mediterranean diet, olive oil instead of butter, lots of fruits and vegetables, all these things seem to be protective. Now, that's not to say that Many people who live this very healthy lifestyle don't get the disease, but all these things modify the risk somewhat. Now, even though people will describe the symptoms as occurring over 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, we think that it's much more insidious than that. We think that this takes place over 10, 15, 20 years. And the starting point is really normal aging. So, present company excluded, of course, at least many people show a decline in cognition with aging. And this decline is mainly in things like processing speed, again, executive functioning, ability to name things, somewhat memory. There are, of course, things that are also improving with age, like our general knowledge, our wisdom, our vocabulary. But what seems to happen is that certain people deviate from this trajectory of normal aging, and they go through an intermediate stage called mild cognitive impairment. And what that means is that there's a decline in memory or other cognitive functions that is beyond what we would expect just by age, but it's not yet interfering with day-to-day function. So if people have memory problems, they can still function pretty well by keeping very detailed to-do lists, post-it notes, keeping a very close eye on the calendar, that sort of thing. Now, mild cognitive impairment can be due to many things, but when memory in particular is affected, it may be the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. And if that's the case, memory continues to decline to the point where it does interfere with day-to-day function. And that is really the medical definition of dementia, a decline in memory or other cognitive functions that is beyond what is expected for age and interferes with normal function. So you can see how these are three sort of arbitrary clinical categories that really represent a continuum, and that there's a lot of gray area, say, between normal aging and the early stages of mild cognitive impairment, or between the late stages of mild cognitive impairment and the early stages of dementia. All right, now, how do the plaques and tangles relate to these clinical stages, to this process? Well, to answer that question, I'm going to take you to the northwest part of Colombia, to a district called Antioquia, probably pronounced that wrong. In this particular region in Colombia, there's an extended family that includes about 5,000 people, and 1,500 of them carry one of these rare genes that cause Alzheimer's disease, and they get the disease in their 40s. And so researchers from Arizona actually flew people who carry the mutation up to get amyloid PET scans. These were people who were at various ages to try to answer the question of how early does the amyloid begin to aggregate in the brain. And so here you see some amyloid scans. These are individuals in their late 20s, and these are negative amyloid scans. What you see here is just the skeleton of the white matter. This is not binding to amyloid. So in the late 20s, there's not yet evidence of amyloid. However, even by the early 30s, you start to see red signal in the cortex. And by the mid to late 30s, really many of these individuals, they're all cognitively normal. None of them have symptoms, but the brain already has a lot of amyloid. In fact, a similar amount of amyloid to other people who are in their mid-40s or late 40s and already have mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So according to this study, the amyloid may begin as many as 15 years before even the very earliest symptoms of the disease. Now, this is true in these rare cases that have mutations, but a very similar principle seems to hold for the more common form of Alzheimer's. What you see here are amyloid scans from individuals in a study of normal aging in the Bay Area, and they're all about age 70, and they're all cognitively normal, and here's an individual who really shows no amyloid in the brain, but here's someone who's already starting to show some yellow and red signal in the cortex, so beginning to show amyloid. And here's an individual who does great on that list learning test that I showed you, no complaints of memory problems, but already has a lot of amyloid, in fact, a similar amount to this patient who has clinical Alzheimer's disease. And this is not rare. We see this pattern in somewhere between 15 to 25% of normal older people. So the amyloid is there. We can find it with a PET scan. Is it just benign? Is it just a benign part of aging, or is it actually doing something to the brain? Well, the early returns on this are that at a group level, at least, many of these people look like they're on the way to Alzheimer's disease, and we know this through other imaging studies. So what you see here is a graph showing the amount of amyloid in the brain versus the volume of the hippocampus, that memory structure. And what you see is that there's a negative correlation, meaning that the individuals who have high amyloid also have the smallest hippocampus, suggesting that even though they don't yet have symptoms, the hippocampus is already shrinking, suggestive perhaps of early Alzheimer's. Same idea here, looking at other regions in the cortex, showing that individuals with high amyloid are losing brain tissue in areas of cortex that we know are very sensitive to Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, if you follow individuals over time, those individuals who start off with high amyloid are at much higher risk of developing a decline in their cognitive performance and developing mild cognitive impairment or dementia. So amyloid seems to be at least a major risk factor for this. So this has really changed our thinking about Alzheimer's disease. And I think in the early days of the modern era of Alzheimer's research in the early to mid-80s, people thought that either people were aging normally and they had no plaques and tangles in the brain, or they had dementia and they had a lot of plaques and tangles in the brain. And we know now that this is a continuous process that's taking place over a decade or longer, and that this is really a cascade of events. And one of the earliest events may be the deposition of amyloid. As people are going from cognitively normal to developing mild symptoms to dementia, the amyloid is rising largely before any symptoms at all, and you can measure that with a PET scan or with spinal fluid. Notice that it's reaching a relative plateau even before the very earliest symptoms of memory decline. Next, we might see deposition of tangles and dysfunction of brain networks. We'll hear more about that from Dr. Seeley, and we can perhaps measure this with CSF levels of tau or with another kind of PET scan that looks at brain metabolism. Next, we can actually measure atrophy of brain structures, and some of this is occurring before symptoms, but this is really becoming dynamic as patients are getting cognitive symptoms. Next, we have the symptoms themselves, and that defines the first stages of mild cognitive impairment. And eventually, we get functional decline, which defines the beginning of dementia. So this is just a model for how this might proceed. I think the sequence of events still isn't clear. But what is clear is that a lot of the action is going on before the symptoms start. And right now, we're treating Alzheimer's disease here, whereas a lot of the action is going on here. And some people have compared this to trying to treat cancer at the stage that it's widely metastatic. There's already been a lot of injury to the brain, even at the earliest stages. And as Dr. Boxer will tell you, the thinking is that if we can begin the treatments much earlier, we might be much more successful. Now, I talked to you a little bit about lifestyle and how lifestyle can modulate the risk of Alzheimer's disease. How does that actually relate to the biological cascade that I've described? Well, this is a really provocative study out of St. Louis that took older individuals, all cognitively normal, asked them how much they had exercised on average in the last 10 years, and then measured their brain amyloid. And so here on the x-axis, you see the brain amyloid, and this vertical line here represents a threshold for a positive amyloid scan. So anything to the right of that is a positive amyloid scan. And here you see the amount of exercise, and this threshold here corresponds to the American Heart Association's recommendation, which is pretty rigorous, 150 minutes a week of moderate aerobic activity. But the take-home point from this slide is that all the individuals who showed high amyloid were in the no exercise to low exercise range. And all the individuals who actually met this very high AHA threshold for 150 minutes a week of exercise, none of them had high amyloid. Now, this is a small study. It still needs to be replicated, but it converges with what we know from some animal models, and I can tell you that when I go to a meeting and go to the gym at the hotel, it's full of Alzheimer's researchers. So I think we all really believe this is true. All right, so let me end by just highlighting a few take-home messages. Alzheimer's is a disease that attacks specific brain networks that are involved in memory, language, visuospatial, and executive functioning. It's caused, we think, by sticky proteins that are misfolding and causing toxic plaques and tangles 10, 15, maybe more years before even the earliest symptoms. As in many fields of medicine, in addition to treating people who are symptomatic, we're thinking more and more about disease prevention, and I think really the Romans had it right when they talked about a sound mind and a sound body. And finally, as you'll hear from Dr. Boxer, the future of therapy, I think, is really going to depend on early detection and intervention with very smart, specific biological compounds. So I'll end there, and just want to take a minute to thank my mentors, Bruce Miller and Bill Jagast, our really amazing collection of researchers at the Memory and Aging Center. And this is the Bill Jagast Lab in Berkeley, where I do all the PET scans. So thank you very much. Now, we're going to take questions at the end, so if you have questions, please write them down. We're going to go through all three talks, and then we'll have 30 minutes, hopefully, for questions and answers. Dr. Seely.
Okay, great. So we're going to pick this up now, shifting gears slightly, to expand your concept of what these neurodegenerative diseases can be, and then also try to share with you some of the exciting research that's going on in terms of understanding how diseases spread and march throughout the brain. So I'm going to start with my take-homes and tell you that when we think about how the brain is organized, it's not sort of a patchwork of isolated, specialized regions that operate independently from each other. Instead, our brain safeguards a host of large-scale, distributed brain networks that interact across large spaces in the brain and interact with each other. And I'm going to try to give you some visual representations of what that looks like tonight. And then I'm going to point out that because of advances in the way we can now image the brain and some analytical advancements in the way that we understand complex biological networks, the tools have really become available now to study brain networks in human beings. And then I'm going to emphasize, and this will be the meat of the talk, the fact that these neurodegenerative diseases, these devastating illnesses that progress in individuals over time, represent organized network breakdowns that begin in specialized regions of the brain and then spread out along these network lines. And then finally, I'll try to end on a hopeful note by pointing out the way that researchers are now applying these imaging methods to follow patients over time with the goal of being able to detect an effective treatment once someone like Dr. Boxer has found one. So this diagram is meant to illustrate five major neural systems in the nervous system. And this could come straight out of a textbook of basic human neuroanatomy. This is on the far left, a diagram of the motor system. This is a diagram of our autonomic nervous system, which moves our heart, our gut. Here we have a network of the balance system and coordination. This one is a network relating to eye movement control. And then finally, on the far right side here, we have the memory circuit. And the punchline of this slide is, of course, that this is not actually from an anatomical textbook. This is from a paper that was written way back in the 80s that speculated that these neurodegenerative diseases, and there's one for each one of our circuits here, are targeting brain systems and marching through the brain in an organized way. So this is an idea that's been around for a while, but what's been missing is a way to go after it. Now, from the 80s forward, there's been increasing momentum for this idea, largely based on postmortem neuropathological studies done in patients who died either in an early stage of disease or in a later stage, and comparing patients along the different phases of the march of Alzheimer's disease. For example, here in this pioneering work by Heiko and Eva Brack in Germany, they identified a progression from a very early stage that involves just these medial temporal memory structures that Dr. Rabinovich spoke to you about, all the way throughout the brain. As you see, the white hot areas in the way I've represented this slide are actually the areas where these neurofibrillary tau tangles Gil spoke about are aggregating. And so as the disease goes on, the pattern moves from this medial temporal lobe out into the rest of the brain and out into the cortical areas. Here you can see at stage 6, a great proportion of the brain has been affected. So the idea that this husband and wife team, Brack and Brack, put together was that the disease was marching throughout this circuitry that they drew in this network diagram. Now, what's changed recently is that we've developed tools to study network organization and functional interactions among brain regions in living humans. So what I'm showing you on this slide, which was published by a collaborator of mine at Stanford University, Michael Gracius, is a rendering of functional MRI brain correlation in a healthy group of young people. So what Dr. Gracius did here is he took this region right here in the posterior part of the cingulate gyrus, a key node in the memory network, and he asked the data, well, which regions in the brain seem to be co-varying over time with this posterior cingulate node in the circuit? And he found that all these regions in orange are kind of synchronized with that posterior cingulate area, forming a functional network. And then he also showed in a subsequent paper that the synchrony among these brain areas was disrupted in patients who had an early stage of Alzheimer's disease. So this was the first kind of proof of concept that that these neurodegenerative diseases are disrupting functional networks and that we could measure that and demonstrate it in the living brain. So that's to kind of set the stage here, but I'm going to shift gears now, just as Dr. Rabinovich did, to tell you about a patient of mine. I too, am a neurologist. I see patients at the Memory and Aging Center and have an active research lab. And what's so striking about this patient, as you can see already, is that the initial problems were not in the area of memory or in cognition at all, but instead in the complex regulation of emotion and behavior. So we'll call this patient FT. He was a 58-year-old businessman who had two high school-aged children, and as is the case for most patients with this illness, he did not come to the clinic on his own seeking help. He was kind of dragged in by his spouse. And the reason that they were so concerned about him was because he had lost his interest in things that used to be so important to him. At the same time, he had started to take up new behaviors, new rituals, new repetitive actions and patterns of behavior that had never meant anything to him previously, and no one thought they should mean much to him now. Oftentimes, he would fail to do things he should do while simultaneously committing an action he really should not. So it was as if both the gas and the brakes were broken. So this patient, strikingly, had preserved language, preserved memory, could navigate throughout town without any difficulty, drove all over the place. All of his skilled movements were completely normal. And the deficits were really isolated to the social and emotional domain. And what you need to see here is that this patient's brain is not normal. And the way in which it is abnormal is quite different than a patient with Alzheimer's disease. So the medial temporal memory circuits of the brain look pretty good. This posterior cingulate area that I mentioned a moment ago for Alzheimer's disease looks pretty good. But these more forward frontal areas of the brain are heavily affected, in particular this area on the medial wall called the anterior cingulate cortex. And then this area right here, which should look like this one on the left side, but instead looks like this. All this dark space here is space previously occupied by brain tissue. And so what you can see is there's been a real contraction in the brain volume in this area called the frontoinsular cortex, and particularly so on the right side of the brain, which we think is dominant, as you learned in previous lectures, for social and emotional functioning. If you were to perform an autopsy on a patient like this, you might find a pattern of neuropathology that looks quite different from Alzheimer's disease. You would see swollen neurons. You might see inclusions in the brain, also of tau, but they're not tangles. In this case, this particular patient had Pick's disease, and this is a small inclusion in the cytoplasm of a neuron called a Pick body. You can see those Pick bodies stained for tau here and here. The tau is also in some of the support cells of the brain called astrocytes and probably disrupting their function. And you can see these Pick bodies abundantly in this particular brain region. So FTD was once thought to be rare and indistinguishable from Alzheimer's disease during life. We now know that neither of those things is true. And in fact, FTD affects about 1 in 5,000 persons aged 45 to 64. And it's the leading cause, tied with Alzheimer's disease, of dementia in this age category, in the patients who develop first symptoms before the age of 65. They're about neck and neck. It's probably more common in patients who develop symptoms before age 60. So really an important and prevalent cause of early age of onset dementia. We really don't know yet how common this illness is after 65, 70. I think there's more and more evidence accumulating that it may be more common than previously thought. It could be that that shift in thinking is because patients were being misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or other forms of late age of onset dementia, but that information is still coming out. So I've kind of set you up for this slide by telling you the Alzheimer Network story and then sharing with you this patient of mine with FTD. And what I want to illustrate here is that we went after the network affected in behavioral variant FTD, this type the patient I spoke of had, by taking a similar approach. So we noticed this area here in the right frontoinsular cortex was so heavily affected, and we went to a group of healthy undergraduates and wanted to study the network affiliations of that area in a healthy set of brains. So to do that, we chose this region right here. We extracted its fMRI signal, how active it was, moment to moment over an 8-minute interval, and plotted that time series like this. And then we sought out all the brain regions whose own time series would have looked like this dashed line or this dotted line, having a highly synchronous activity with that seed region of interest. Everybody with me so far? See a lot of nodding heads, that's good. And then what that allows us to do is make a statistical map of the correlation between the seed area, that right frontoinsular cortex, and other regions in the brain. And that statistical map looks like this. And this just made my eyes pop out of my head because I thought to myself, this looks exactly like the pattern in behavioral variant FTD. Now, we ended up coining a term for this network. We call it the salience network because these brain areas are kind of recruited together anytime we're engaged in the heat of the moment and having to sort of put our finger on exactly what's the most important thing to do right now and make a decision about that next kind of instrumental action. And that's clearly a problem for patients who have a degenerative disease affecting this circuit. And when you compare an atrophy map made from, let's say, 24 patients with behavioral variant FTD, shown here in blue, to a connectivity map derived in completely healthy brains from young people, you can see how strong this overlap is between the areas that are connected with the right frontoinsular cortex in health and the areas that degenerate in behavioral variant FTD. So we thought, why stop there? Let's see if this is a class-wide phenomenon. Let's go out and gather up patients from all of the different focal neurodegenerative diseases that we see in our clinic and see if each of them has a network. So you've heard already about Alzheimer's disease and behavioral variant FTD. We studied three other clinical syndromes that are fascinating in their own rights, all devastating neurological degenerative diseases. Semantic dementia is a progressive loss of word, object, person-specific, and emotional meaning. So it begins with a difficulty with naming, coming up with words, and progressively patients lose all concepts about meaning in the world. And you can see why that might be the case, because in contrast to the behavioral variant of FTD, which more often affects the right hemisphere, semantic dementia is caused by a focal degeneration in the left temporal lobe, which we think is critical for representing semantic constructs. Progressive non-fluent aphasia is a progressive difficulty with speech output. Patients become frustrated and unable to generate fluent speech. Oftentimes their grammar is disrupted, and you can see that that's also from a left hemisphere degeneration that's anchored here in a region called Broca's area, which is an important output node in the language network. Corticobasal syndrome is a Parkinson's-like syndrome where there's usually asymmetric difficulty with moving limbs. The limbs become stiff, rigid, sometimes have too much tone in the limbs, and progressively patients become unable to use those limbs effectively. So we see these particular clinical problems in our clinic routinely, and we gathered up patients with each of these different syndromes. We made atrophy statistical maps, shown here in blue, just as I had shown you before for behavioral variant FTD. And you can see that each of these maps is quite different at the group level when you do this statistical test. And the blue areas are statistically atrophied compared to controls. And these are focal patterns, and then within those focal patterns, there are sort of accentuated nodes within the system where the atrophy is sort of at its peak. And I've drawn colored circles around each of those nodes of peak atrophy. And so what we did, as you might guess, is that we took those peak regions, which I'm showing here in isolation, scattered across the brain, and we used those to derive networks in the brain with this idea in mind that there might be kind of an epicenter, a focal point that gets this network-based degenerative process going. And what we found was that if we compared the atrophy maps and we to the network seeded in healthy brains by each of these five different candidate epicenters, we derived a set of networks that looked very much like the atrophy pattern. So it suggested to us that this network-based degeneration wasn't just something seen in Alzheimer's disease and behavioral variant, but was probably a class-wide phenomenon. But this left us with a few questions, and I want to spend the next half of the presentation talking about some more recent work that we've been doing to try to really go after this and understand it better, see how we can apply it to making our patients better. So one question that this left was, are these atrophy peaks that we used to derive the networks really sort of the core epicenters? Does this concept have any legs? So I'm going to get to how we went after that. And then we wanted to get a little bit of a better feeling for how the disease might spread along networks. Is it that the networks all share some common factor that makes them vulnerable to the disease once it gets going? Or is it something more kind of mechanical? I'll say more about that. And then finally, I wanted to know, well, how soon can we get this technology into the clinic in a way that will help patients? So I have to slow down for a moment now and talk a little bit about network science. Because when you think about networks, there's a whole mathematics behind network science that really guides the way we go after these analyses now. And networks are everywhere. All of us use network science every day of our life. So the Google homepage is run by networks. And I'm sure there's no one in the room who hasn't landed on the Google homepage in the last few days. Anyone who occasionally travels by air is familiar with networks. And here's one on the board. You're all Bay Area denizens, so you probably recognize this map. It is a United Airlines flight map. Some of you may consider it a chronic debilitating illness. But if you wanted to understand that illness, you would need to go after these core nodes in the network that seem to be these buzzing hives of activity. And you can see one of them is San Francisco. That's why this joke makes sense to you. The other is Denver. Here's Chicago O'Hare. And in a network map like this, we can talk about the network in terms of nodes and edges. The nodes are all the airports in different cities around the country. And the edges are represented by these curved lines, which tell us whether a flight exists between node A and node B, between San Francisco and Denver, for example. But we can actually derive mathematical characterizations of these nodes and edges that tell us something about how critical they are in the network, what role they play in the flow of air travel across the country, or more generally, in the flow of information across a network. And if we really wanted to know what was going on a given day in the United flight plan, we would have to go and zoom in to this particular node, which is a key hub, Chicago O'Hare, and it has its own unique features that probably induce its vulnerability. It's certainly not in the most clement part of the country in wintertime. And there are other features about it, this freaky walkway that you probably all know, where the crazy lights overhead, and you know, it's got all kinds of things going on. But, you know, the point here is that for United Airlines to work well, this node in the network really needs to be functioning. So what we were wondering after this study I described to you earlier was, well, we chose this right frontal insular cortex region as our epicenter because it was the most atrophied. But what we really want to know is which region within this whole blue map is the region at the center of the BVFTD flight map or network, if you will. And so to do that, we had to actually carve out little regions that I've circled here across the blue map and understand how these regions relate to each other. So we wanted to know not only how are all of the regions around this region connected to it, we wanted to know how A is connected to B, A is connected to C, to D, etc. And then how you can imagine how that becomes an iterative process in which we have to build a very elaborate data set. And that data set looks like this. So each region would be listed down both axes. Each region's correlation with itself, the strength of that functional connection, would be listed down this diagonal. And so what I can tell you here by looking at this is that certain regions are very strongly connected with each other. Those are shown with the hotter red, orange spectrum colors. And certain regions are not connected to each other at all, as you can see in the blue areas. And what that tells me as well is that there are particular areas within this system of brain regions that seem to be widely connected throughout the system. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for that hub, that O'Hare within the system. And those regions are located right here. You can see their connections down this way, horizontally and vertically in both cases. And there are these regions right here that I pointed out on our patient in the first place, the right frontal insular cortex and the anterior cingulate gyrus. So that was good news. So we can re-represent that matrix of brain regions I just showed you in graph form. This is starting to look a little bit more like the flight map, but it's very dense. And what I'm showing you here is nodes in colored circles. Each one of those nodes is a brain region. And edges, or connections between two nodes, in white lines. And the shorter the line, and the closer the nodes are together, the more tightly connected they are. The nodes that are more on the periphery are looser affiliates in this network. And the nodes that are most centrally placed in the graph are the hubs. And you can see those here in the insula and the cingulate. So we expanded this effort to those four other diseases that I've been talking about throughout this presentation and found that each of them has a small number of core nodes that really seem to serve as these hubs or epicenters for the disease. And we hypothesized that those epicenters would serve as sort of a gateway into the network along which and from which the disease might spread. And so to look at that, we decided to collapse all of this data together into one place across this entire expanse of brain tissue that we were studying across all five diseases. So to do that, of course, we had to take all the circles from all the diseases, pull them apart, string them out, and put the data back together. And it was an incredible thing for me to look at because I felt, you know, like I was seeing one of the more interesting data sets I'd ever seen in my life. And so here are the different patterns. You can see them grouping together down the diagonal. But you can see that not only is there are there functional connections within a disease pattern, there are some functional connections between disease patterns. So for example, down in the far right lower corner, we have this corticobasal syndrome. And in the far lower left corner, we have its interaction with the Alzheimer's disease pattern. You can see there's quite a little bit of overlap here. So the idea we had is that maybe not only the within-network connections, but also the between-network connections are critical predictors of how the disease will spread out over time. And we thought if that's true, and we could calculate a metric for how connected every region in this entire matrix was to every other region, we could test this hypothesis by relating that information to the amount that region degenerates in the context of disease. So we could do that by understanding where these home networks are and then studying both them and the off-target networks. And so what you can see here is a string of correlation plots looking at the relationship between the length of that path from the epicenter to the given node in the network and the vulnerability of that that node. And so what I'm showing you is that for each of these five diseases, the shorter the path to the epicenter node, whether you're looking in the home network or the off-target network, the more vulnerable that region is to the disease. So it supported our idea about this. And so what we imagine and would like to do going forward is test the idea that if we know where the disease is at time zero, and we follow patients over time at subsequent intervals, we'll be able to know exactly where that disease should go next. So, for example, if this is our epicenter, and this is a more simplified graph than the one I showed you earlier, we should be able to know that the next wave of disease will come in the nodes most closely interconnected with this epicenter, and that the next wave will look like this, then this, then this, and the epicenter will continue to get more and more atrophied over time, but the disease will begin to fan out into its partner nodes. And the way that would help us, I think, is to deal with some of the variability that we see between patients. So if for an individual patient, well, let's say this patient's disease began right here. We could say this is the key targeted area. We could build a graph specific to that patient's target node and then make patient-specific predictions about where the disease should go next. And then in the best scenario, the one we're really eager to see, compare those predictions to what happens in the context of a treatment trial. When a patient is delivered an experimental drug or a placebo, we'd be able to see how their trajectory changes in response to that therapy. So we'd like to be able to do this sort of longitudinal study. We've taken a little bit of a look at this so far, and this is just the beginning stages. We're in the process now of trying to follow in collaboration with Adam Boxer and others here at UCSF, patients from different degenerative disease groups over time to be able to really watch this process unfold in real time. But as a starting point, we took a cross-sectional look at this in a group of patients who had behavioral variant FTD. And what we found, as I'm showing you here, is that the degree to which this brain region that we keep talking about, the right frontoinsular cortex, is connected with the overall network is correlated with the severity of deficits that patient has in a cross-sectional study. So we hope this will translate into a longitudinal result where an individual's progression over time can be monitored with imaging. And interestingly, those back of the brain regions that Dr. Rabinovich talked about that are so affected in Alzheimer's disease, they were going in the opposite directions. They were actually getting stronger and stronger over time. An interesting side story that I don't have time to completely unpack. So I'll just close with this idea that if we can do this cross-sectionally, we really hope to be able to build this kind of a study where we have a real live clinical trial, placebo, active therapy, and monitor this network connectivity at subsequent intervals and then use that as sort of a surrogate marker for how the patient is doing. We'd, of course, never be happy or satisfied to make the network graph look better. It has to be accompanied by a clinical improvement. But we hope that the network graph might give us a little bit of a beat on whether we're headed in the right direction. And this is beginning to become a boom industry. It's even being done now in rats. You can see this is the rat brain. And people are drawing these kind of graphs and networks based on doing fMRI in rodents and a huge scanner with a tiny little bore in the center where the living rat will sit and think about whatever rats think about. And and then you can make a connectivity map out of that. The reason it's important is that for mice and rats, we use these organisms constantly to test therapies that could someday be used in patients. So I'll close there and just acknowledge the many collaborators and colleagues who helped me work on all of this. It's a pleasure to be with my colleagues, Dr. Rabinovich and Dr. Boxer, here at the Memorinating Center, and our critical funding sources. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm Adam Boxer. I run the clinical trials program here at UCSF, and I also direct our new clinical research unit in the neuroscience building that some of you, I think, got to visit last week or the week before. And really what we're hoping to do at UCSF is create our own hub, like Dr. Seely just talked about, but for really developing new techniques and new treatments to cure neurodegenerative diseases. And so I want to tell you a little bit about some of the new approaches that we're taking to do this. And I want to focus on frontotemporal dementia or frontotemporal degeneration that you just heard about from Dr. Seely, because although it's a very tough disease, we think it may help us to cure many of the neurodegenerative diseases. So you heard a lot already from Dr. Rabinovich about Alzheimer's disease, and I think any talk about treatment of dementia should really start with Alzheimer's disease because it's the most common of all of the dementias that we see clinically. Just to sort of reiterate what Dr. Rabinovich said, that, you know, most of our patients come to see us with some sort of cognitive complaint, usually memory. Sometimes it's them, sometimes it's their family that complains. We do a number of tests, including a brain scan, and we do blood tests to rule out other forms or other causes of their memory problems. And depending on the severity, if they really have a problem, we might call them mild cognitive impairment. Dr. Rabinovich explained that that's when the symptoms are mild, they're present, but they're not severe enough to interfere with day-to-day function. Or sometimes we would call them Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia if they're really severe enough to get in the way of day-to-day function. And so right now, for Alzheimer's disease, we actually do have medical therapies as well as other ways to treat the disease. And the most common ones that you may have seen on magazine pages are called acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. There are ones called Aricept. Another one that's commonly used is called memantine. But we also know that other things can help people with dementia, such as exercise, minimizing cardiovascular risk factors, minimizing other drugs that might get in the way of their brain function. And also we can treat behavioral and psychiatric symptoms with standard psychiatric medications or non-medical interventions. And so all of these things we can bring to bear on dementia right now, and they do help. But unfortunately, they don't cure the underlying biology, and they don't really address these sticky proteins that Dr. Rabinovich talked to us about, the amyloid and the tau. And so the brain damage continues to accumulate. So I like to think of the current treatment sort of like an engine treatment that helps lubricate the wheels of your brain, but really the damage is still sort of accumulating. And what we want to head towards are really fixes for the broken engine. And so as Dr. Rabinovich hinted that Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and it's really a big problem for our country. This was a study that was done starting in 2003, but it's projected that by the middle of the century, there may be on the order of 14 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease. And much of this is due to the aging of the baby boomer population, with age being a major risk factor for Alzheimer's. But it also presents us with some opportunities. If we could just find a therapy that delayed the onset of disease by 2 years, because of this aging phenomenon, we'd actually over time have many fewer patients. And if we could delay the onset by 5 years, we could really cut the number of patients by mid-century close to in half. And so although it's a difficult problem to treat the biology of the disease, there's some hope for our different therapies. So this is a different picture than what Dr. Rabinovich showed earlier, but it's the same nasty proteins in Alzheimer's brains, the amyloid plaques that look like fried eggs to me, and the neurofibrillary tangles that are formed of this tau protein that are inside the cells. And most of the new treatments that we're working on and that are actually being tested in humans have focused on trying to remove these amyloid plaques or the constituents of these plaques. And we've been fortunate to have, again, as Dr. Seely just mentioned, animal models where we can actually, poor mouse, but we can actually create mice that get Alzheimer's disease. And we can do that by taking the genes that cause Alzheimer's disease in these rare families, like the one in Colombia that Dr. Rabinovich talked about, and introducing them into mice. And we can use these to develop the new therapies. And so, you know, with this, we've actually developed hundreds of successful therapies for Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, we can cure this Alzheimer's disease very well in the laboratory. Unfortunately, human Alzheimer's disease has been a little bit more complicated, and many of the Alzheimer's therapies have not translated so well into humans. And so that's one of the major challenges for our field right now. So what types of treatments have we come up with by focusing on these Alzheimer mice? And so many of the treatments that, again, have made it to humans so far, this is actually a picture of a cell. So this is the cell membrane. This is the outside of the cell. This is the inside of the cell with Alzheimer's disease. Here's a plaque. Here's a damaged neuron. Here's that amyloid precursor protein that Dr. Rabinovich talked about. And many of the therapies that have been developed have been aimed at blocking the formation of this beta amyloid, which goes on to form the plaques, or to sucking it out or clearing it out of the brain. And so there have been different small molecules that can block some of the enzymes that cleave the amyloid precursor protein. But also some of the most advanced therapies now have actually been immunotherapies. So like a vaccine that you would get for the flu, there are actually vaccines and other immune molecules that we can get to target the amyloid and actually clear the amyloid out of the brain. And this is the same PIB, the Pittsburgh compound B, that Dr. Rabinovich showed you that lights up amyloid from a recent study with a drug called bapineuzumab. And you can see that this is after 78 weeks in a placebo-treated patient. There's more red here, more amyloid accumulating. So this is from baseline to 78 weeks later. But in a number of the cases that got this treatment, the amount of amyloid actually decreased. And so this is a nice proof of principle that using these immune therapies, we actually can have an effect in humans removing the amyloid. Unfortunately, bapineuzumab is a drug that recently failed in human clinical trials. We can remove the amyloid from the brain, but for some reason, it doesn't actually cure the disease. And so that's a mystery, and it's a challenge that we're working on. And so the question that many of us are asking is, are we maybe treating too late with these amyloid drugs, or maybe is amyloid not really the best target for a therapy for Alzheimer's disease? So this is, again, another version of that nice cascade that Dr. Rabinovich showed you earlier. But what we know is that amyloid in most people who go on to get Alzheimer's disease is starting to build up while they're still cognitively normal and reaches a plateau by the time they have mild cognitive impairment or dementia. But this other protein, tau, so here's the tangles, actually builds up later and is still increasing during this mild cognitive impairment stage. And so most of the clinical trials that have been done with the anti-amyloid drugs have been done at patients at this stage when the amyloid's really been there for a long time and there's a lot of amyloid to remove. And we think perhaps that it may be too late when we use a drug at that stage, at least one that's targeted amyloid. It may be possible, however, that if we had drugs that targeted tau, we could still use them at these actual symptomatic stages, and they might have some benefit on these patients. So because many of the amyloid drugs like bapineuzumab have recently failed in clinical trials, the next really exciting thing that a number of people are working on are prevention trials. And the idea is to use these techniques like PIB to identify people at the very earliest stages of disease and where they're preclinical, and then give them a drug that might remove amyloid while they're still very early in their disease, possibly before they have any symptoms. And the hope is that by doing so, you'll prevent them from ever declining or getting the disease. And we're about to see within the next year that there will be at least two, maybe three studies like this. Two of them will be focused on genetic families. One is the family that Dr. Rabinovich showed you in Colombia, where we'll be giving anti-amyloid therapies at times long before the symptoms developed, but that can be predicted because we know the genetics and the course of disease in these families very well. So stay tuned. I think in a few years we'll find out whether this works. But I want to switch now to treatment of frontotemporal dementia, and I think that this is a disease that's not been as well understood, and so there really are no effective therapies. But we are developing methods to treat frontotemporal dementia, and we think that by doing so, we may also help to treat Alzheimer's disease. So Dr. Seely gave you a very nice explanation or illustration of what frontotemporal dementia is, but just to remind you, it's a common early onset form of disease. It frequently involves behavior, social function, and language, and not often, not so much memory like Alzheimer's disease. And this is associated with tau protein pathology in the brain, sort of like the tangles, but a little bit different. And again, Dr. Seely showed you a picture of the tau pathology in FTD, or another protein called TDP. And we think that because FTD is very tightly linked to one, either of these two molecules, that there are certain syndromes that may actually be easier to treat than Alzheimer's disease. Now, I know that sounds hard to believe, but I'm going to tell you a bit more about that later. Also, we know that FTD overlaps with other diseases like ALS or Lou Gehrig's and possibly with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So again, if we're successful with FTD, we may actually help to treat these other diseases as well. And importantly, we have nothing right now that really helps FTD patients. So these are the three common forms of FTD. The most common one is the behavioral variant. That's what Dr. Seely described a patient with earlier, and I'm just going to focus on this. And this is my what I call my Mickey Mouse pathology diagram, and I hope Dr. Seely won't cringe too much because he's our the head of our brain bank. But So the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia really, as I said, is about 50% of it has this tau protein in the brain at autopsy, and about 50% has this other protein called TDP43, and a small percentage has another protein called FUS. But it turns out that these proteins are also found in other common neurodegenerative diseases. So tau is also found in these diseases called progressive supranuclear palsy and corticobasal degeneration, whereas TDP43 is found in Lou Gehrig's disease. And interestingly, clinically, we often see overlap between these different syndromes that parallels the pathology. As I mentioned, tau is found in Alzheimer's disease as well, but the tau is a little bit different. And importantly, in Alzheimer's disease, we have this beta amyloid, which is really not present in most FTD. We also know that FTD is associated with specific genes, and these specific genes have given us clues of how we might treat FTD. So, for example, progranulin, always when people have a mutation in this gene, they almost always get FTD with TDP43 pathology, and it may be that there are ways of actually helping to restore progranulin levels that may be treatments for the disease. And unfortunately, I won't have time to talk to you about that today. I'm going to focus more on tau. It turns out that there is a gene for tau called MAPT here, and when a human has a mutation in this gene, they almost always get one of these tau-related FTDs, either FTD itself or PSP or CBD. And what I want to tell you a bit more about now is that we think that this is an opportunity for us to actually focus on these diseases to better develop tau therapies. This is some really important work done by somebody named Rabinovich, who's in San Francisco. I've never heard of him before. But just to, again, sort of tell you that that we can use amyloid imaging. This is Pittsburgh compound B to help us diagnose FTD. And I think as this finds its way more into the clinic, we're going to realize that more and more dementia patients probably have FTD. And so it's probably even a more common disorder than many people realize. But Gil, Dr. Rabinovich, has shown very nicely, better than anyone I think in the world, that most FTD patients really do not have amyloid in the brain when we use these scans. And so even though they have a clear dementia, they do not light up with Pittsburgh compound B. And so again, another illustration that although there's often tau in the brain, there's no amyloid, and we wouldn't expect amyloid therapies to help FTD patients. So we've been working on developing new therapies for FTD, and These are some of the Alzheimer's medicines that I talked to you about before, and these are frequently used in FTD because people are just looking for anything to help people. And so we recently conducted a study of memantine in FTD because there was some belief that memantine helps FTD patients, and it turns out that many U.S. FTD patients take memantine. Other medicines that are sometimes used are psychiatric medicines, but the one that people had the greatest hope for right now was memantine. There was a small study done in France that suggested that there was no benefit, but we just completed the largest study ever done in FTD. And as I mentioned, in the U.S., about 33% of FTD patients take memantine. So I think I'm going to skip this, but we looked at, we used a number of standard measurements that we use in clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease, and we applied them to FTD. And we looked to see whether memantine could actually improve behavior in the disease, because that's what many people had reported before. And we screened about 100 FTD patients at 9 centers around the country, and about 40 were allocated to memantine, about 40 to placebo, and each of them were treated for about 6 months with these, with either the medication or placebo, and we looked to see whether memantine actually helped the FTD patients. And although there was a very transient benefit after 6 weeks, this really became not significantly different, and so there wasn't really a huge benefit or really any significant benefit after 26 weeks in FTD. And interestingly, when we looked at the patient's day-to-day function, the memantine group actually did worse than the placebo group. And so although there was slightly better behavior, their function was worse. We also looked at a number of cognitive tests, and there was evidence on a variety of cognitive tests that the patients with FTD who took memantine actually did worse. So also they did worse on a naming test as compared to the placebo group. And so unfortunately, it looks like memantine is not going to be an effective treatment for FTD. But what we did learn is that we can do clinical trials in this disorder, and we've developed the methods to actually use so that once we have more effective therapies, we'll really be able to know whether they work or not. So really, again, we've been thinking about FTD because it may have advantages for drug development, because there are these genetic links, because the patients are younger, and we have biomarkers that may help us to develop treatments. There are also other FDA incentives that may allow us to develop treatments. And so the one protein that we've been focusing the most on is this protein called tau that makes up the neurofibrillary tangles that I showed you pictures of before. And our colleague Eric Roberson, when he was here at UCSF, did a very nice experiment where he showed that if he knocked the tau protein out of these Mousheimer mice that get Alzheimer's disease, most of the mice actually die after about 6 months, but if he takes the tau protein out, they actually survive and they do much better. And not only do they survive the Mousheimer's, they also survive seizures that that are brought on by a toxin. And so tau really, we think, is the ideal target for perhaps many of these neurodegenerative diseases that we're focusing on. Dr. Seely just told you that many of the diseases that we work on actually travel in networks. And another colleague of ours, Mark Diamond, has done some really pioneering work that suggests that tau can spread along networks. And so, again, we think that blocking the spread of tau may also be an important tool for many of the different diseases that we focus on. And so over the years, our colleagues have been thinking of ways that we could target the tau protein. And there are many different points where we could do this. So tau is actually a protein that's bound to the microtubules in these neurons. And when the tau is affected in disease, the microtubules become unstable, and so we could stabilize them, or we could try and remove the toxic tau with antibodies. And all of these different types of therapies seem to have some effects in mice and are starting to make it into humans. But really, which human disease should we use first? And we think that really these tau-related FTDs may be the best because really they're very pure tau pathology, and we know that if a person has one of these tau-related FTDs that that they have very few other competing proteins like amyloid or TDP-43 that might mask the effects of one of the tau drugs. And so our program is really focused on FTD, PSP, and CBD, what we call tauopathies, to develop new tau therapies. And of those diseases, there's a disorder called progressive supranuclear palsy, which has a very long name, but basically is named for its eye movement abnormalities, its stiff neck, its dementia, and trouble with swallowing. And this actually is due to the accumulation of tau in areas throughout the brain, particularly in the brainstem. And so we focused heavily on PSP in our drug development efforts. And one of the projects we're doing is actually using different imaging techniques and fluid biomarkers like the CSF that Dr. Rabinovich talked about to find ways that we could actually look for drug effects in this population. And so what types of drugs would we help hope to test? Well, one that's actually shown some promise in PSP is something that targets the mitochondria, something called coenzyme Q10. And this is a study by Maria Stamelu and Günter Hoeglener from Munich, where it turns out that mitochondria are the energy centers of neurons. And coenzyme Q is a vitamin or supplement that helps the mitochondria to work better. And when they gave them to PSP patients with this pure tauopathy, they actually saw a small benefit on a number of clinical measures. And so this is one of the exciting therapies that is now moving forward in larger clinical trials to see if it might have a benefit. Another possibility is that we could actually affect the enzymes that modify the tau protein. And so one of them is called glycogen synthetase kinase. And what this does, it's a protein that actually adds phosphate to the tau. And when it does that, the tau becomes stickier and becomes more toxic. And there have been a number of small molecules developed that can block this enzyme. And in mouse, in these tau transgenic mice, it has really big effects. It helps them to remember things better, and also we can show that it actually blocks the phosphorylation in the mice. And recently there was a clinical trial that was done with a human version in humans with this drug, with a drug that blocks this GSK3 beta. Unfortunately, it was not shown to be efficacious, but it turns out that using these sensitive imaging techniques, we were able to detect a small potential benefit. And so it may be that this approach may be something that we could pursue further, particularly if we had a better, more effective version of this drug. Another exciting possibility is that we could make up for the loss of tau. So this is actually an electron microscope of a axon, part of the neuron, that looks very sick because the tau protein is dysfunctional. And by actually using drugs like the anti-cancer drug Taxol that bind to microtubules, we can actually make up for the lost tau and improve their function, improve mice's function with these drugs, and also, interestingly, reduce the amount of tau that accumulates by just stabilizing the microtubules. So the first of the drugs to do this is called apothalone D, and it's actually very similar to Taxol, but it actually gets into the brain, and you need very, very little. You don't use the anti-cancer dose. You use probably 100 times less. And this is just entering a clinical trial that is going on around the country that we will be starting here in Alzheimer's disease probably within a month or so. And we hope to soon use this in PSP as well. Finally, I mentioned that there were immunotherapy for amyloid. It turns out you can also create antibodies or vaccines against tau protein itself. And we think that, in my mind, this may be the most exciting new therapy that's being developed because, as I mentioned, tau appears to be able to spread from one neuron to another.
And so this is a study that was done by a group at Eli Lilly, where they used standard antibodies against tau protein and showed that by just injecting them into these tau mice, that they could actually improve their survival and they could improve their motor function as well, just by giving these different antibodies that block that or suck up the tau. And we could show they could also show in the mouse brains that these reduce tau accumulation. There are no tau antibodies yet in human clinical trials, as far as I know, but I think in the next year we will probably see a number of these, and we hope that, again, we can use these particularly in PSP because this may be the best of all of the diseases to test these types of therapies. And we think that if we can show that one of these drugs works in PSP, that may also predict a response in Alzheimer's disease. Finally, we've recently completed a trial with a drug called devunetide, which also acts as a microtubule stabilizer. This is our UCSF-centered network that I had to show of all of the sites around the world that are testing this drug. The last patient just finished the study, and we should have the results in about a few months. And so we hope that this may actually be the first tau-targeted drug that we can show really works. And so stay tuned. In a couple months, this may hopefully be an effective therapy that we can bring to bear on FTD. So what did I tell you today, and what would I like you to take home? So there have been a number of failures with amyloid-directed therapies in Alzheimer's disease, and it may be that the reason is that we've been using amyloid therapies too late in the disease, and so there are a number of prevention studies where we'll treat very early, perhaps before symptoms start, and we hope these will work better. Unfortunately, there are no drugs to treat FTD, and when we looked at the most commonly used one, memantine, it actually made our patients worse. But we think that FTD may have many advantages for drug development, and particularly if we focus on these proteins tau and progranulin, this may be really a way that we can develop effective therapies for a variety of different neurodegenerative diseases. And we're developing new tools here at UCSF to do this, we will be finishing the first pivotal PSP tau trial with devunetide this year, and we believe the first international FTD clinical trial with a tau agent should begin this fall. So stay tuned for that as well. And I'd like to thank the people who were involved with the memantine clinical trial, a group of people who are working to organize new FTD treatment studies, and a variety of other people who are collaborating on biomarker development. So with that, I'm going to end.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.